get on to the next topic, which is backed by popular demand. So we always ask about the topics that people want to cover in the feedback. So please remember to fill the feedback forms. We do look at them. And so the tax updates are always very useful for a lot of the members. And so, yeah, it's back as well. We've got some new speakers today, not been at the before, but from also working, many of you remember Dirk Lambrecht, he's not there today, but we've got two EY experts for us. So there's Dr. Dennis Weiler who's going to speak first, who's an expert international tax, been, I believe, 9 years at EY as well, even more maybe.
6 years in EY and before 3 years in another company.
Okay, yeah. Got it. Okay, good. And Sang Hoon as well, also at 13 years, I believe.
At 13 years, yeah.
13 years, okay, good. So we've got over 22 years of experience there together, so that's very good. Maybe you can introduce yourselves as well. I think, over to you.
Okay, thank you. Hello, thank you for having us here. My name is Dennis Weiler, and I would like to start with a fun fact about my last name, Weiler. Weiler, that's the word for a small town within, like a village, but which consists only of one street. And the same, I think, should be a hamlet in English language, so we can also call him Mr. Hamlet if we want.
Or Prince.
Okay. To be or not to be.
Yes. Right. And, okay, so on the right you see my contact details, and on the left you see the agenda that I have for you for today. I would like to start with some EU topics, and then I would go over to German domestic topics, all topics from German and EU legislation. So I would like to start with Pillar 2. I can imagine you have already heard about Pillar 2 so far. Some have not. This is about to give you a broad overview over this set of rules. What's very important is that these are rules which have a goal, which is bringing a minimum taxation of at least 15% over all jurisdictions where a group of companies is operating. That's the overall goal, and the goal is to get those rules in all the countries all over the world, in the best case, such that a group of companies is taxed with 15% in the minimum. Maybe more, but at least 15%. And what's also important to note for you is that this is not kind of replacement of tax rules in these various countries. It's just a second different layer of taxation which comes in addition. So it's just a lot of disclosure and reporting in addition to what is already existing. Yeah? Okay. And another name for Pillar 2 rules is GLOBE rules, and GLOBE rules has two components. The first, that's the primary rule, that's the so-called income inclusion rule, IIR. And the secondary mechanism is the under-tax payments rule, UTPR. That's the most important things about this rule. And I now show you, give you a broad overview of how these rules should work. So we have here on the picture a small group of companies, and we assume there's consolidated turnover of at least 750 million euros, because that's the threshold after which the rules apply. And what are you doing? You look at the different entities in various jurisdictions, and you combine the entities per jurisdiction. You have a jurisdictional view. And then you compute the ETR, the effective tax rate. How do you do it? You take the taxes, current taxes, and also deferred taxes, and you bring that into a relation with income. And then you have the ETR. you measure whether the ETR is below or above 15%. If it's below 15%, then you calculate the taxes that would be necessary in addition in order to bring the ETR to 15%. That's the so-called top-up tax. Now you have heard the most important buzzwords, IIR, UTPR, and the top-up tax. And that's it. And now there's only difference in the mechanism how to collect the tax. So the primary rule is the IIR. And it follows a top-down approach. So when you have a look at the top entity, that's the ultimate parent entity. And this ultimate parent entity, it will compute the top-up tax for the subsidiaries and pay the top-up tax in its jurisdiction. So in this example, country Y, country Z, the tax authorities will not get the tax. Tax authorities in country X will get the tax. And then there are constellations where the ultimate parent entity itself, for example, has an ETR of below 15%. And for these cases, you also compute the ETR and the top-up tax. But in this case, it's not the ultimate parent entity who pays the tax, but the subsidiaries. That's the UTPR. And you're asking now which subsidiary is paying it? They are all paying it. It's apportioned and paid in the various countries where the subsidiaries are located. Okay? And one thing maybe, there's a de minimis rule. That means where the revenue is below 10 million and the income below 1 million per jurisdiction, there's no top-up tax. And so this sounds quite simple, and the basics are simple, but the details are very complex because it's an own set of rules. It's based on financial accounting data, but with a lot of changes, amendments. So it is, so to say, an own tax gap, which is being established with that as a different second layer of taxation. Okay. So that brings me to the next page. This is the overall BEPS 2.0 timeline. And you maybe know BEPS 2.0 is split into Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. Pillar 1 is not subject of this presentation, so I only talk about Pillar 2, which is the yellow line here. And I don't want to mention everything on this slide, only the most important things. Very important is here the release of the OECD model rules as of the end of last year. This is, so to say, the blueprint of the rules. If you have that, you understand the rules in much detail. And you see also 2 days later, as of December last year, there was released a draft directive by the EU. It's pretty much the same, but just for all the EU member states. And you see also here in this picture, it was primary intent to bring those rules into force as of the beginning of next year for the IIR. But in the meanwhile, it really looks like it's being postponed by 1 year, at least. And that brings me to the next page, where I would like to give you an overview what happens in different jurisdictions. So when we start with the EU, you know, in the EU, you need all the EU member states to approve. And we haven't reached that yet for Pillar 2. So there was a new amended draft directive, which also provided for to postpone the whole rules by 1 year. But it didn't find approval with all the EU member states. So Hungary did not give its approval. And that was the reason. So in the European Union, the process got stuck. And that was the reason why some EU member states said, okay, no matter what happens with the directive, we will introduce it according to the draft directive. And that's the states which are shown here, France, Italy, Netherlands, Spain, Germany. So they will do it. For Netherlands, we have already seen a draft bill. For Germany, we have not yet, because Germany waits for some other documents from the OECD for so-called safe harbor rules. No one really knows yet how they look like, or they will look like, but they might ease the situation which comes from the problem that you have to apply all these rules in order to compute the ETR, just in order to find out that you're above the 15%. And that's the problem. And the OECD tries to find out, find a way around to make it easier if you have clear cases where there's no low taxation. Okay? And it's also important to understand what are the other big countries in the world doing, especially the United States. So far, the United States have minimum taxation rules in place, GILTI and a quite new corporate alternative minimum tax. But these rules are not equivalent to Pillar 2. So you can say the United States don't have Pillar 2 in place. And it's not foreseeable whether and when they will have it. And as I already said, the OECD, they are working on some other working items like an implementation framework for that's something for developing countries in order to help them to get that into legislation. And especially the safe harbor rules. So that's my update on Pillar 2. I hope you could get a broad understanding about what it is. Yeah. And
do you know what the situation in the UK is?
Honestly, I don't know what the situation is. But maybe someone of you knows.
Then I'm not going to ask my question. Do you know? And about the developing countries, you mentioned something. And the developing countries? Like
yes.
Zambia.
I know. You need to see the OECD is a club of almost all the countries in the world. Yeah, and
it's 20, yes. But not all countries.
Not all.
So,
but for this Pillar 2 initiative, there were over 140 countries in the world which have consented that they want to do it. Yeah, and the good thing about these Globi rules is that you have now a blueprint in order to get something like that into the legislation. So you can take it and put it into your law. So that's that's their intention. They want to make it easy for all of them in order to make sure that the rules are uniform, you know, everywhere the same.
Which notorious tax havens have not consented to
take part? Yes, you can imagine that. There should be some tax havens which have not consented, but I cannot tell you from the top of my head which have. Yes, but there might be
some. The Netherlands?
That could be the UK.
I mean, the Netherlands are the first movers. Yeah, they have already a draft bill in place for these routes. They are quite early. Yes. Please.
And what if the parent company is in the US and all the other companies in the EU, and for example, India will not join the initiative, how does it work for the residual 16% in Europe?
Yes, that's a question that a lot of people and companies have. And I've told about the UTPR mechanism two slides before. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what could happen in such a case. So you have a group which is headed by the US. There are US companies and below some European companies. And it's just sufficient that some of these companies which are in countries where the rules were adopted. And then it affects the whole group. Yeah, and if the United States don't impose the top-up tax, then it will be done via the UTPR mechanism in other countries. And that's the problem with that. So you get not out of these rules just because the United States will not play with. Yeah?
So each country then has to calculate the difference, right, between the effective taxation and the fiscal taxation to each country. Each country subsidiary.
So I didn't get it. Can you please
repeat? Each country subsidiary then has to calculate the difference between the 15% taxation and the effective taxation.
It has to be calculated for all the entities in all the jurisdictions. The good thing is you can make a centralized approach because the rules are typically everywhere the same. So you can, maybe it would in the US had a group, it would maybe even a US team which is driving the topic even though there is no tax in the United States. But it's a centralized topic and the information which is necessary will typically be available at the top of the entity. So if you have a German entity and they want to calculate the UTPR for the US top entities, they will not get the information. Yeah? They will not have it. They will have to ask. So it can be had for that aim from the beginning.
There's no effect of loss carry forwards going up?
The thing is you have a separate layer of taxation. So it can be that you have no tax payment in a certain jurisdiction because you have available tax loss carry forwards. So you would end up with current taxes of zero. But this isn't the end of the song. You would ask, oh, do I have deferred tax assets on the available tax losses? And if this is the case, then you might end up in a situation where you're not low tax because of the deferred taxes. That's the good thing about including also deferred taxes into this mechanics. Okay. Any further questions?
So which gap will be applied?
Yes. So it can be different gaps which are being applied. So it typically starts with that gap which is being applied by the ultimate parent entity. So if it's a US group, then it will be US GAAP. It could also be in Europe, IFRS, for example. And then you will have to apply that GAAP for all the subsidiaries. Even if, for example, for group consolidation purposes, an entity is not material enough, and you have never transposed the GAAP into the US GAAP or IFRS, but for these purposes, you will have to do.
So this is basically an international version of subpart F.
It's similar, so it's an additional tax for the subsidiaries. If the subsidiaries have a certain do not reach a certain minimum taxation level,
but only if they are taxable.
Yes.
So if it's loss carry forward zero, it remains zero. Then you've got the other subs that pay a minimum of 15%. That's fine, and then it goes to the next level. And is the sum sort of like smoothing, or does it remain at that level, or does that answer have to be 15%? Does the subpart F have to be 15%?
No. When you see, for example, subpart F rules or the German rules, which are similar to that, they are very technical. So there is a relationship between the parent entity and the subsidiary, and the income will be included at the level above. Yeah, and that's not what's happening here. You treat every jurisdiction separately. You just measure, is there ETR, is there not ETR below 15%. You calculate the top-up tax, and then it's being paid somewhere, wherever it might be. Direct subsidiary, parent entity, might be another entity, might be another subsidiary. It's just a very static system compared to the systems we know.
Is the control concept based upon the ultimate parent company gap?
No, there is no control.
To determine whether or not it's subsidiary?
Yes, there is a control concept. So you test, is there a group, a multinational group at all? And then you rely on a concept which is pretty similar to the control concept for financial accounting purposes. So if you have a consolidated entity, subsidiary, then it belongs to that group. And it can even more subsidiaries belong to that group. As I just mentioned, so when you have excluded a subsidiary for materiality purposes, it will be included again for this purpose. And you have special rules for joint ventures. Sometimes you don't have a full consolidation in joint ventures, or at equity consolidation, you have special rules for this purpose.
What happens at a local sub-level between loss carry forward 0% and an active company that's paying normal tax, which would be less than 15%? So is there a grading, like a path? So let's say in land X, there's a company that is company one that pays nothing, so there's no cost up. Company two has the cost of its loss carry forward, maybe a small rate of tax. Does that have to be then brought up to 15%, or does it pay a small tax? And then does the company three, which is paying the normal rate of tax, which is 14%?
It depends, because you have the so-called jurisdictional blending that you apply for purposes of these rules. So you have a combined view of different entities if they are located in the same jurisdiction. And then you add up all the income for all these entities, and you add up all the tax payments, and also the deferred tax payments. So the fact that there are loss carry forwards and there was no current tax being paid does not necessarily mean there will be an ETR from below 15%, because you include the effect in the P&L from the recognition of deferred tax assets. Yeah? So and then you have a combined view. It can be that you have entity one, which has paid zero taxes, and you have company B, which has paid 30% taxes. You combine the income, you combine the tax payments, and in the end, it could result that there is no taxation below 15%. But it could also happen quite the opposite, that you are, just because there's one legal entity where there was, for whatever reason, not so much taxes, that you can, for all the whole country, get to the result that there is an effective taxation of below 50%. That can happen. That's because of the jurisdictional blending that's being applied.
Will the Germans enforce the German side, even if in the previous question the UK will not enforce the UK side because they don't have it, or the US?
I mean, in the UK, you go back to the 25% tax rate, right? Mm-hmm. So it was quite...
It
has quite a history, right? I have one client for which we computed every year the deferred taxes, and we have seen these plans for the change of the corporate income tax rate for quite some time, and it has a major impact on the if you have tax loss carry forwards and have to build up the deferred taxes, it can quite be, so this is 6% difference in tax rate, right, which you have currently. Okay, are there any further questions? I mean, I'm totally out of time, and I have only covered one topic. When did we start?
At what time?
10 past. So it's only 5 minutes.
So we can ask some more questions.
Sure, you can. Sure. I mean, you will be provided with this presentation.
I have a practical example.
Yes. Sure. Go ahead. Yeah.
So I've got a company in Germany. Yeah. And then I've got a sister company in Zambia. Zambia is in Africa.
Yes, I know.
Thank you. So, I am, now in short, to make it easy, do we have the German tax, like the standards which they link to developing countries and stuff like that? Which can I prepare my accounts in Zambia? Which, even if I translate them into German, using my Zambian accounting standards or whatever.
So I understand. So you have in this example a group of companies, and it has
only two companies.
Only two. So the parent entity is the German.
Yeah.
And the subsidiary is the Zambian.
Yeah.
And then you would start with determining, is there a group of companies? You would come to the right, yes, there is, because there is group consolidation. So then you would say, okay, there's a multinational M&E, and if the turnover consolidated is more than 750 million, then you're in the rules. And then you have to decide which is the applicable accounting standard for these rules. And for this, you typically look what is being applied at the parent entity level for financial accounting purposes. And this would then maybe German GAAP or most likely IFRS. Yeah, most likely IFRS. And then for the computation of the ETR, you would then come to the result that you have to transpose the Zambian GAAP financial statements into IFRS statements. That's what you would have to do. And this is something, I mean, in a lot of groups, BEPS 2.0, Pillar 2, will be most likely driven by tax people, but not only by tax people, because there's a strong linkage between tax and financial accounting for this purpose. So they will have to build up teams which are joint teams, where not only tax and financial accounting people are in, but also techies. Yeah? So because what I said earlier, it's a uniform approach, and it makes sense to centralize. And because you need so many information, it makes sense to do it automatically. So to get the information that you need right from the system, that the system gives you all the details, and that it can compute it on itself. It would be far too complicated to do it on an Excel spreadsheet. Yeah, That's the main task, and that's a huge exercise which companies have ahead of themselves if these rules become enacted as it's currently foreseeable. Yes. So I just show you what other interesting topics I had. maybe you want to have a look at it later or at another time, and you have my contact details. You can also contact me if you have questions. So in the EU, we have 883 UNCHEL, very interesting initiative in order to have a standardized approach for detecting shell companies, empty shell companies, and mitigating that tax benefits are obtained just because of the interposition of a shell company. A lot of jurisdictions have anti-abuse rules like that in place, but the interesting thing is that this is a new rule, completely new, and shall be uniform within the EU. And another interesting EU initiative is the DEPRA initiative. There's also a draft directive out. And this is about giving an incentive, reducing the incentive to leverage a company a lot, and giving an incentive for having more equity in an entity. Because the interest expense gets a haircut. Not so much interest will be allowed to be deductible. And on the other hand side, if you have equity, you get a fictitious interest expense on the equity. That's what they want to do. And the intention is clear. They want to make sure that companies have a higher cushion in order for absorbing losses. So they want to do something against the tax incentive to have so much debt in the company. And I also wanted to provide you with a quick update on Section 49. So that's something you heard about last year already. The good news is the German parliament wants to abolish the rules, but not completely as of now. They do it in some kind of staggered approach. The rule is about licensing and IP transfers. It's a strange situation that you can have a tax obligation in Germany even though there are no German entities, just because the licensed IP is registered in Germany. And this has caused a lot of problems in the last 2 or 3 years. We were very busy with clients that we made disclosures and tax payments. And now the German tax legislator says, okay, we abolish the rule. We do it retroactively for the third-party cases. And we do it as of 1/1/2023 for the group cases. And for tax haven cases, it will remain in place. Yeah. So whenever you have licensing with an offshore company on Antigua, maybe, then you will have the full set of rules still in place. Okay. And then, yes.
I think we need more time for this.
Oh, yes. Okay. Next time, maybe. Next time we get.
Come on, we're in Germany.
What Winston Churchill said? There's nothing so sure like death and taxes, right? Yeah. I could talk about this for the next 2 or 3 hours if you wanted, but I make the cut now. And sorry for taking 3 additional minutes. And yes, so that's it about the corporate tax and international tax update. Feel free to ask me any questions that you may have later. And now I would hand over to my colleague for the TP update. Thank you.
So Dennis, thank you, and thank you all for having me here. It's a great honor. My name is Sang Hun. I'm from the Transfer Pricing Department of Ernst & Young here in Frankfurt, Eschborn. For those of you who might wonder what is transfer pricing and what do I do actually the whole day, you might have heard of companies such as Starbucks going to Ireland, having placed some IP there, setting a lot of millions, billions of taxes. That's the stuff that I do, used to do. We don't go to Ireland anymore. It's not so sexy. Singapore is it's a good country nowadays. Luxembourg, partially. We also don't go to the Netherlands anymore. Netherlands, I don't know, they're, you know, no fun anymore, so to say. Plus all the things Dennis mentioned, especially Pillar 2, ATAD, those issues make my life actually really hard, right? And I don't know, maybe I'm, you know, once Pillar 2 comes, ATAD comes, maybe I, you know, need to get myself a new job. anyways, in short, that's transfer pricing. So transfer pricing is you have a group of companies, so at least 2 companies, you have at least 1 border, and you have intercompany transactions. So group company A selling products to group company B, or providing services, or giving out loans, giving out licenses, IP rights, whatsoever. So this is basically transfer pricing. And why is it important, and why? What is the connection between transfer pricing and tax? So we have a border. We might have different tax rates. And obviously, within a group, you know, due to the price setting of your intercompany businesses, you might shift profits from country A to B in order to maximize your make your tax rate over the entire group efficient. So that's basically what happened with Starbucks in Ireland, right? And obviously you can not do it at your own will because there are national laws. And basically the national laws in most of the countries in this world say for intercompany transactions you need to follow the arm's length principle, which is basically saying, you know, you need to conduct businesses within your group of companies as if you were to do these businesses with third parties. Right? So the business transactions within the group must be at arm's length. This being said, there are two odd issues in transfer pricing nowadays in Germany. The one being we have a revised German ordinance on transfer price on transfer functions. I will come to that in a second. The second interesting issue that we actually do see on a daily basis right now, intercompany financing. So we're talking about interest rates, the conditions around interest rates when a group company A gives a loan to group company B. This new German ordinance on business function relocation or transfer function. So what is a transfer function actually? So you have a business function, right? Business activity that along with chances, risks, tangible and intangible assets, or any other kind of benefit, you transfer from country A to country B. And along with that, you would transfer profit potential, because you know the business that you do today in Germany has a profit of, I don't know, 100 euros, and you pay tax for it. Now tomorrow you would do it in the UK, right? You would earn 100 euros pounds in the UK tomorrow and subsequently pay taxes there. And obviously German tax authorities have a problem with such structures because they say, look, this was my tax, now you know it's UK tax, we don't like this idea. So they're saying, yes, of course, I mean it's a business decision. If you want to transfer functions within or across borders, you can do it, yeah. But if you do, you pay taxes here. You pay taxes in Germany for leaving this country, actually. Now, this is a bit harsh because we are talking about a tax, real tax, on profits that you have not realized yet. Right? We're talking about real tax on potentially future profits. So it's like.
It's a deemed disposition.
Right. It's like.
Which is not unusual in tax systems around the world.
No. Yeah. That's it. It is like you know me as a German tax authority saying to Neville, you should have made 100 euros, and then if you had made this 100 euros, you would have paid 30 euros in tax, right? So, and unfortunately for you, you don't actually have made this 100, but, you know, you still pay 30 euros tax. And obviously, you know...
Sound too fair to me.
No, and the thing is, and I will come to that, in terms of valuation, right? How typically such a transfer function valuation works is basically kind of a discounted cash flow method, right? And if you talk about big manufacturing function, distribution function, research functions, whatever, right? Whatever business activity you transfer, we're sometimes talking about millions, three-digit millions, where also seeing cases where we are talking about billions. Right? And I've seen cases where the taxpayer was deemed to pay tax, but he just couldn't because he just didn't have the liquidity for it. Right? And this is what transfer function basically means. And we have this new ordinance since October this year. And this ordinance, however, is applicable for starting January 1st this year. So it's a retroactive regulation.
So what happened in that case? You know, you have a company that was taxed but didn't have any liquidity. So did they go bust?
No. We obviously tried to reduce the tax burden first. And we were able to let it, to actually reduce it. But nevertheless, the tax is there, right? And you can kind of, you know, appeal to the tax authorities to split the tax payments, right? And so they are now, I don't know, paying the tax over the next 4 years.
With interest?
Sure. It has been reduced, right? From 0.5% a month, so 6% a year, to.
I think it was 2.5. I'm not sure, and there is a flexible component included.
Yeah.
But it's far lower than the original 6%. But we will have to see how it will further develop now if we have higher interests in the world again. No?
Otherwise, you have a hidden financing source.
Yes, it's a hidden financing source for the tax authorities, for the German tax authorities, and I bet they will be quicker with increasing the tax rate compared to lowering it, because it was necessary that the highest court in Germany had to make a decision before the interest was lowered. Yeah.
But for following the rules that the previous have acted your rules, then we assume that maybe the head office function is moving and is subject to these ridiculous estimates, but then the operating company would be able to get them back through your 15% ruling.
Yep.
So, you know,
the German tax rate is higher than 15%.
Yeah, yes, but you would then be able to force the offset. That's what I understood from the previous statement.
Can you say that example again, please? Can you say it again, the example?
Okay, so now we've got an operating company in Germany, and we've got a head office, and we've now decided to move the head office for whatever reason, and the Germans want a ridiculous amount of tax. But because of the rules you just described, where the higher tax paid can be used to offset the tax due on one of the other subsidiaries under these transfer rules, if it's actually get the money back.
But only if it's in the same country.
So it would be in Germany. So you've got your operating company in Germany, mm-hmm. and you just moved the head office from Germany to wherever. Mm-hmm. You should then be able to force an offset.
Let me think about it. So if you do it, so in the first instance, you would have the ridiculous taxation on the exit, yeah, in Germany, in the high taxation jurisdiction. High tax, there is no low taxation. Then you have the transfers being made to, let's say, a low tax jurisdiction, and there in the future, the profits will be taxed, but with a tax rate below 15%, just as an assumption. And then comes on top, you're right, this additional Pillar 2 rule, and would then impose an additional top-up tax in order to make sure it's 15% at the moment.
The top-up tax would be negative if both entities were in Germany.
If both entities were in Germany, then you wouldn't have in the first place the transfer exit tax, because it's only applicable for transfers abroad. So if it's transferred within Germany.
One was being transferred abroad, mm-hmm. so you get ridiculous tax, mm-hmm. but you still retain an operating company in Germany through these
Pillar 2, you would force the tax onto the operator itself.
I'm not sure I can follow.
I think you know what I'm talking about.
But can you apply the double treaty? As you always said, tax on the top.
Yes.
So it doesn't apply the double treaty which we have in EU and with the other countries, right?
No double tax treaty.
Yes.
This is
right.
Because he keeps thinking of the tax treaty
to avoid the double taxation, but you said tax on top, so I'm thinking anyway it will come on top of whatever it is. You can't go.
I presume this only applies to transfers outside of the EU because otherwise you run afoul of the EU right to move your business through.
No. We've discussed this. And literally, German tax authorities say we don't see any violation of that. And because German tax authorities are also saying, you know, this is international standard, right?
Yeah.
Everyone does it. Everyone has it.
Yeah.
I tell you, UK does not, right?
Yeah.
But
I knew that a lot of other countries have this. I know Canada does.
Yeah. But not in this very very specific form as Germany does. So that's particular. Now the story about transfer function rules in Germany. Started 2008 when the transfer function as such was first introduced into German formal law. Back then, the German tax authorities said, it's nothing new, right? We always had it, but we are just specifying. It was followed by something called Funktionsverlagerungsverordnung, which is this term right here. And this is the ordinance. So it's not formal law, but it's de facto law. It has essentially the same rank as law in Germany. It was followed then in 2010 by the administrative principles. Administrative principles are binding for the tax authorities, but not for the taxpayer. And obviously, you know, our advice to taxpayers is, you know, as far as you can live with it, please follow the administrative principles, because that will save you a lot of discussions with tax authorities. And then, recently, what happened in 2021, last year, and I need to look it up, we talked about it today. So in 2021, a law was introduced. This is this ABZSTENTMODG. Now, it's my personal, really, my very, very personal impression, but German tax authorities tend to make everything really, really, really complicated. Because... because... This A, B, Z, and so on and so forth, right? So the official name for it is Gesetz zur Modernisierung der Entlastung von Abzugsteuern und der Bescheinigung der Kapitalertragsteuer. I had to look it up multiple times because I just can't remember. And even the German tax authorities seem to kind of thing, well, you know, the name could be a bit too long. So they said, let's name it Abzugssteuerentlastungsmodernisierungsgesetz, yeah, which is a bit shorter as the one that I named before. Now, obviously, this is even considered to be too long, so they kind of decided to name it ABZSTENTMO. Now, ABZST and so on did, they changed the definition of the wording of the transfer functions in Germany, and the tax legislation said, "Wow, that's good. We'll take this chance to release a new ordinance, a revised ordinance." And they said, you know, why do we do that? Because the law has changed. And we want to create certainty. We want to help the taxpayers to better understand and better interpret the law. So they published this new ordinance, which is, as I said, in place since October. And the result is it does not actually help the taxpayer. It worsens the position of the taxpayer. Really, really, really worsens. Just a few examples. So the significant changes, in regards to the TOF rules. A transfer function will be assumed even if you partially transfer function, not entirely, just partially. Right? So that will be considered as a transfer function as such, eventually triggering exit taxes. And according to the German tax authority view, a restriction of this function in Germany is not even required to assume that you have transferred something of value to another country. So if you expand or duplicate your business elsewhere, this will cost you tax money.
So that means a liquidation won't help?
No.
If you liquidate your head office, what you've just said means you still want tax.
Yeah, sure.
On a liquidation.
Because the position would be, why haven't you left your head office in Germany? Why did you move? Why did you go elsewhere? Right? In regards to the valuation, the tax authorities are now saying you need to consider tax effects. And how this works, I will show you on the next slide. Also regarding the valuation, and I talked about this, basically a DCF method. The tax authorities say instead of using the company weighted cost of capital, instead you need to apply a market rate. Right? Obviously, the transfer function regulations also apply to a head office and its permanent establishment abroad. And the last point I will skip for a moment. Now, this one is quite interesting. If we talk about DCF, we always talk about the capitalization period, and by default, German tax authorities assume an indefinite capitalization period. And before October, or before this year, if you were able to, credibly demonstrate that the capitalization period is shorter than indefinite, then you could apply that. Massively reducing the exit taxation. Now, what the tax authorities say is, making it plausible does not suffice anymore. You need to provide evidence. Now, how I understand that is the German tax authorities are now saying you need to provide evidence for something that will happen tomorrow. So, that would be great, right? I mean, lottery, for example. And so this is just a very, very generic view on how things would change. So we have two options. Option one, basically reflecting the old understanding of the law. In this example, I have a limited capitalization period of 5 years. I have a 5% discount rate, and my DCF model would yield 704 euros. And now with this unlimited capitalization period, with all the other parameters being equal, I end up with 4,622 euros. So that's, I don't know, like 7 times the value, right? And if you want to go down from this 4.6 to 704, you need to, as I said, provide evidence. The rule is new. We need to see how this works out actually in reality. Discount rate, well, back compared to market rates. Obviously, if the gap is not that much, then the effects are rather minimal. The last part is quite interesting as well. So you need to consider tax rate. So what does it mean? So when I as a company sell something of value, I kind of make a profit and have to pay taxes on it, right? And the German tax authorities say now a prudent, diligent business manager would account for the tax burden rising out of his transaction and would make the buyer pay his taxes. So, in other words, it is kind of the same thinking, I guess, when Donald Trump said, I'm going to build this wall and make Mexico pay. So, this in short, the rules about transfer of functions. Are there any questions?
Sorry, but aren't I then paying the taxes twice?
Sorry?
Aren't I paying the taxes twice then?
Once when I leave
Germany and then when I make the profits in the new country.
Yeah. Okay. That's the fact.
But that's nature of capital gains tax.
Yes. You have to consider that you have a step up in basis in the optimal case. So when the transferee can make a recognition of the assets and the goodwill potentially on his balance sheet at fair market value, and then get depreciation. So in an optimal world, it would offset against each other, except for the difference in the tax rate. That would, of course, it could be an advantage or a disadvantage. But over the long run, it could offset each other because of depreciation.
And the tax payable in Germany is deductible only in Germany, right? So it could also, yes, we pay for that transfer in Germany, and I know that this tax is deductible only in Germany.
Can you repeat it? I didn't understand. Sorry.
I know for sure that the tax that we pay for the transfer preparation is deductible. Is it deductible just in Germany? Well, I cannot deduct it in another country.
No, the tax is being paid by the transferor. Yeah. And as tax always, it's not deductible
it's
for
not
tax
deductible.
Purposes. Okay. No.
It would be deductible part of the subpart F.
Yes, if you have a crediting method at the parent level, if the transfer is going to the parent, or if it's sideways and the income is being picked up from the parent, yes.
Would this all lead to companies making their transfer of businesses and operations more formal so that they would actually value the various assets that they are transferring more precisely so that they can take advantage of capital allowances and goodwill in the other country that they're transferring to?
Unfortunately, this is not going to work because the German tax authorities prescribe a specific method how to value this transfer function as a so-called package.
Right.
And they say, well, you need to kind of apply a hypothetical arm's length method. This is how this method is called. Of course, you could specifically value single assets added up, right?
The difference would be goodwill, and then
right.
You can say this is what my transfer was, and then in the host country, you could say, well, this is what I transferred, and then say, well, these assets. Amortize and depreciate over time, including goodwill, and you might be able to get tax advantages, at least in the host country, even if it has a lower tax rate.
Yeah. that is the case in the Gulf country, they could have deviating methodologies for the evaluation of the incoming assets.
But you have an incentive to try to match the valuation in some way to move it across, right?
You could certainly try.
Does it also apply to internal service functions?
In principle. So if you have an accounting team here in Germany, and you move your accounting team to Poland, right? That would be basically considered a transfer function, as such. In that particular case, and I understand there is a lot of accountants here, right? Don't get me wrong. This is, you know, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but because this is the wording of the German tax authorities, they say accounting functions, they're just low value adding. Routine services. And by the way, the same applies to tax functions as well. And the transfer of a routine function, right, will not trigger this form of exit tax, provided that this function remains routine once it has been transferred.
Now I have to ask, so do the engineers count more?
Yes, they do.
Really?
Yeah. So because engineers, you know, they are close to because engineers are rather close to intangible value contribution, right? And in terms of, you know, engineers usually create IP, right? And IP is typically from a taxation point of view, IP is typically where tax authorities assume high values.
I have one question. So this question is actually real world. This thing was this for that. As a transfer pricing, say, is for example, any company based in here, not in Germany, IT company, they've grown up and it's now started. So now they want to move to another country like head office. As your explanation, what I understand, there is a specific rule applied from the tax authority and forced to pay tax. In that case, if they change another strategy, they change the company, establish there, and another country and uses service from their controlling in here, totally change the name of the company. And what can be impacted if transfer pricing issues? You understand my question?
So we have a German company, and we have a foreign company, and the foreign company uses the services of the German company. Was it that?
This is based currently in German company, based in Germany.
Yes.
So they want to move headquarters to another country, low-cost country or whatever. But as for your explanation, what I understand, it's going to be tax authority put something as a transfer or whatever, no? Put to pay tax. If they want to totally change the name and they put head office another new country and they service from there, take order from there, and because they already have customer, this whole relation and they change the company logo and name, everything. And on that point, tax authority have anything issue?
I would guess yes, the German tax authorities would actually have a problem with that, because the question is always, you know, I mean, we understand you want to change your brand, you want to change your image, you want to change your whatever strategy and so on, but why don't you do it here? Right? Why did you move to another country to do that? Right?
We have to pay for the tax.
and, and it's always this thinking, you know, whatever has been kind of, you know, whatever has its roots in Germany, and you transfer that to another country, it's not forbidden to do that, but please pay your taxes before you go. That's it.
Is function, part function also applicable to this?
Yep.
Yes. What happened when, for example, you built, you know, your new function in another country? You increased, you know, the amount of people working there, and then you wait a little bit, and then you fire everyone in Germany. Is that also considered as a transfer?
You need to wait at least 5 years. Yeah, there's actually five year period of you're not allowed to. I mean, you can fire some people, but I wouldn't fire all the people. You know, I would do that after 5 years, and then you're fine.
Basically, follow the European job transfer rules, and you understand what those are. Then transferring the function, would it work? Under the employee transfer rules, probably not, then you're going to have to end up on the impacts. If you can get by the European employee transfer rules, job transfer rules, then you can probably escape the impacts. So it's a rule of thumb.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, moving employees as such, right, would not trigger this exit taxation.
So a lot of employees would claim that, you know, they've been fired here because their job is being transferred to them.
Yeah.
Okay, so if the process that you go through for a business would fall foul of the transfer rules, then the chances are you have to pay tax.
I like it.
And if you can get by without the transfer rules, then you probably can get by without paying any tax.
Like it. I mean, the thing is about this transfer function and what do we actually expect? As I said, you know, the intention was to clarify the rule. It was to make life easier for taxpayers, and unfortunately, this is not happening. And we do expect that we will have a lot of disputes with tax authorities in the future, even more than before. And what we encourage is to have such transfers documented in a timely manner, on a contemporaneous basis, to have a solid defense position against the tax authorities, because, you know, this rule sounds, well, maybe not fair, but quite clear. But such cases always result in a dispute with tax authorities, and we have cases where we can argue, you know, yes, we have moved something, but we are not going to pay taxes because, you know, this has nothing to do with tax. We did move it due to business reasons and so on and so forth. We have cases where we are able to massively reduce the amount of exit tax. So, but again, you know, this is all, you know, this all depends on how solid your defense case is. And the second issue, and in the interest of time, I would just really briefly go through it. So the status quo is in intercompany financing. We are constantly fighting a war against the tax authorities, obviously. That's what we do. And intercompany financing transactions, so majorly intercompany loans, are often subject to dispute. Good for us and good for the taxpayer. The German fiscal court has made two really decisive decisions in 21 and 22 that, in our point of view, is actually to the benefit of taxpayers. And problem here is the German tax administration, right? They, despite the federal fiscal court decision in 21, the German tax administration published an administrative letter telling all German tax authority members to behave in a way that is not in line with the court case and court decision. So the key issues in loan transactions is one is a loan that a mother company gives to subsidiaries. Is that debt, right? Are the interest payments actually tax deductible, or is it equity? The federal fiscal court says, if A and B conduct an agreement, a loan agreement, then obviously it should be a loan, it should be debt, and interest payment should be deductible, tax deductible. By default, German tax administration say, no. You have to first, do an analysis whether the money that the mother gives to its subsidiary is really debt or equity. Because equity, interest that you pay on equity will be not deductible for tax purposes. Another issue, implicit group support. Implicit group support is the increase in a company's rating just due to the fact that this company is part of a group. So two companies in a combination have a better overall rating than one company on a standalone basis. On the other hand, what could implicit group support mean if you are part of Mercedes-Benz? Yeah, your implicit group support is probably really, really high, other than if you are part of a lesser-known group of companies. When pricing loans, must the collateral be considered? Either price increasing in case there is a collateral, or reducing the interest rate where no collateral is given. The same for subordination. How to deal with subordination, and how what effects do subordination have to the interest rate to be applied? And which transfer pricing method should be applied when pricing intercompany financing transactions? And then, to whom is a loan or risk premium of interest to be assigned? This is a very, very TP technical part, so let me skip question six for the moment. Our conclusion out of the recent BFR, so the German Federal Fiscal Court rulings, and no debt capacity analysis required. So what does debt capacity analysis mean? Debt capacity analysis is basically when you try to get a loan from someone, this someone will analyze whether you will be able to repay the loan at all at some point in time. German tax authorities actually say, for each and every single intercompany loan, such a debt capacity analysis required. The German fiscal court says, if the intent of the parties is actually to give a loan, then the intent is to give a loan. Why would in each and every single case a debt capacity analysis be required? And by the way, if you go to a bank and you want a loan, they wouldn't always do a debt capacity analysis, right? So it's third-party behavior that debt capacity analysis will not always be required. And then the question is it equity or debt, right? Is intercompany loan equity or debt? Court decision, again, it depends on the specific agreement, and will this loan be considered appropriately under German statutory gap? And if that's the case, then it should be accepted as a loan. Again, German tax authorities see it a bit differently here. Functional risk analysis of lender is not relevant. So what is a functional risk analysis? Functional risk analysis refers to, you know, what does the lender do, what are his activities, and what are the risk boundaries, activities. And out of that, German tax administration say you need such an analysis to derive the appropriate interest rate for an intercompany loan. And again, the fiscal court says, no, you don't need that. The CUP method. The CUP method, CUP stands for comparable uncontrolled price method. So it's comparing prices of a similar or comparable transaction with your transaction. So if you talk about the loan, 1 million, you might go to a bank, ask, so what would I need to pay for 1 million loan? Bank would eventually tell you, I don't know, 3, 4, 5%. And that could be considered a CUP. Now, the thing is, in a group constellation, it's really hard to find external CUPs. Because, obviously, if I go to the bank and request a million...
Sorry, just to say we wrap up soon, because we've got the last one is at quarter to, otherwise we might push over to...
Sure. Yeah. Thanks. So obviously, it always depends on, you know, the party going to the bank requesting this 1 million loan. So if Never goes to a bank, he would likely get other conditions than I would get, right? So a CUP is quite difficult to maintain, to identify, but nonetheless, this is, I think, applying this CUP method for intercompany loan pricing is the one that where German tax authorities and the fiscal court are actually of the same opinion. Collateral. Here, the view also is the same. It should be priced or considered when pricing an intercompany loan. And implicit group support, right? Implicit group support is the one thing that distinguishes companies or company ratings within a group, right? To companies that are not part of the group because they just don't have this implicit group support. And again, here, the Federal Fiscal Court says implicit group support should generally be acknowledged, considered that the subsidiary is strategically important. We don't yet know what this means, to be honest. When is a subsidiary strategically important? And then the German tax authorities demand a business purpose test. So they demand an analysis, justification. Why does this subsidiary need money from its mother company, right? And the fiscal court, and I'm trying to translate it here, I think their wording was kind of, well, it is none of the tax authorities' interest why this company needs money. Recent tax audit experiences. We are fighting. We do, however, see cases where we are able to push through even higher interest rates lately. Likely in the next years, it will even be more of that case. Typical pitfalls, no intercompany loans. Agreements, missing agreements, always kind of a, you know, really, really hard to defend case in tax audits. And also, we always recommend to have a proper documentation in place, also documenting how did I end up with that interest rate of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% or whatsoever. This is my contact, so again, if you have any questions, please let me know, send me an email, and thank you for your time, thank you for listening, and